Okay, good afternoon. As you may figure out very quickly, I managed to come down with a spring cold, so we'll see if my voice holds out or not. Fortunately, they say by the time you start to show symptoms, you're no longer contagious, so you don't have necessarily wear those cool masks that people wear to protect themselves from being infected. But be forewarned that, again, I tried not to talk very much today, and we'll see if we can stretch her all out. So the first thing I want to do is hand out code-generation notes 3 and 4. Those are be our primary business today. So let me just get those started around. If you already grabbed a copy, just you don't need to get a second. So let's get started then. Today's main plan will be to go over the two sections of the notes I just handed out, sections 3 and 4. I want to make it clear, and we'll talk more about this, that the order in which you actually implement things is not necessarily all of 1, all of 2, all of 3, and then 4. Rather, I started with what I thought was the simpler concepts and then got into the more advanced routines. Actually, I think a good way to start, and a few people have already done this, is get to the point where at the very beginning you can print strings and integers. The reason for that, almost all the test programs print something out. And if they don't print anything out or you can't see it, you have no way of knowing whether they operated correctly or not, no notion of correct or not. So the parts of the code that actually do the class generation and then at least a method for main and then the print statements for integers and strings are among the first things you'll want to do. After that, I think a good choice would be arithmetic expressions because they're fairly straightforward and you do arithmetic all over the place. And not just arithmetic, but expressions in general. So do addition, subtraction, multiplication, comparisons, etc., and get those working. Then assignments early on, because assignments are all over the place. Then probably ifs and whiles, because those are loops and the main body. At some point, you'll need to put in variables, either globals or locals or both, but whichever one you do first. And then some of the miscellaneous other details like breaks and continues, returns for functions, et cetera, et cetera. But just do them piece by piece. So we'll be talking about code generation today, and as time permits, we'll finish up talking about garbage collection. You won't be doing garbage collection in your project, but it is included in Java, so we kind of use it indirectly through the Java system. C Sharp has it, C++ has it in an odd sort of way. Even C has a limited amount of garbage collection, and we'll talk about that, sort of how do you retrofit something into a language that was never designed for it. Now, does Cache have garbage collection of some sort? Or I ought to really learn the language because I'm always talking about it and I know so little about it, but I'm not so sure. I guess some people, as I understood, got a hold of some documentation from Epic, and they ended up owing Judy $1 billion, and that does not fit in my budget. So even at $10 a week, it'd take a long while for me to pay it all off. So maybe I'll have to just get it secondhand. Our final lecture will be next week, and in that particular case, we'll be talking about code generation, remaining aspects of code generation, including possibly some extra credit stuff. Particularly, I want to talk about jump code, which is an odd sort of computation where you keep track of a value not by putting it in a variable, but rather where you are in the code. In a sense, we do that all the time, although we don't appreciate it. If, for example, you're executing code in the then part of an if, you know indirectly that the conditional that controlled it had to be true. Alternatively, if you're in the false part of a program of an if, then you know that the expression that tested must have been false. And you can use that information, and we'll see how you can use that in unexpected ways to increase the efficiency of doing fairly complex control expressions. So we'll talk about that. I think I'll also talk a little bit about changing while loops into for loops, because, again, that's something people might want to do as extra credit. And then we'll have a review for the final exam. So that's our plan of attack. We have some miscellaneous points. Most of you know this. I didn't. Anna didn't yesterday. Is that the password for the public Wi-Fi has changed. So I know there are a few others who are not Epic employees but are just taking classes here. And if so, if you're trying to log into the guest to the guest network, it won't work. You can talk to me or one of your fellows about what the new password is, or even if you're an employee, you may not have been reading your mail and you may not have caught that. So that's something to know. I also wanted to show you something that came up yesterday that is easy to miss. And this is part of the transition from the code generator I gave you, which is for CSX Lite, into the code generator for full CSX. So let me suspend this for a moment. And essentially, what this is the very top of the CSX.java program. And right around line 57, there's a couple of comments. And let me explain to you. So you might want to make a mental note. It looks like it's around 56 or 57 for about five lines. What happens is you have to get information about the name of the class, because our rule is that you generate a class corresponding to what CSX has, and you generate the actual file, the .j file, the Jasmine, based on the name of the class. It turns out that in CSX Lite, there are no classes. So what I did here was simply assume that the name would be test. You see that that's around, what is it, 60 or 61. I'm kind of looking at it cockeyed. But what will happen is when you go to full CSX, if you don't change that, what will happen is you'll be generating a program in some parts, assuming the class name is whatever CSX gave, and other parts will be assuming it's still test because we had that remnant from CSX Lite. So what you need to do is that line right above it, just take the comments off, and what this will do is extract the proper name from the AST, and then that'll go ahead and change the class name to the proper name and have the file that you're going to be generating, the .j file, have the proper name. So if you've been having problems, and we saw a couple of cases yesterday, that in some cases you're seeing a test.j where you should be seeing something else, it simply means you haven't read that comment and done that minor change. So my experience is if one person has a problem, others may too, and it's better to short-circuit it out now. So I thought I'd just show you that. We've actually given it to you, but sometimes you have to realize by reading the comments carefully that something needs to be done. So that was point two. Also, there still remain some questions about the actual targets in the build.xml test one versus test two. And here's the differentiation. When you're first starting to generate code, you may not be generating a complete .j file that Jasmine will accept. That means it may be missing some boilerplate, like the name of the class, the name of the parent, the superclass, etc. It's okay if you generate incomplete files as long as you don't try to assemble them and execute them. So the test one target will stop at the point where it displays the .j file you've generated. If it's incomplete, that's fine. You look for the part you're working on. Does it look like the expressions are fine? Does it look like the assignments are fine, etc.? At some point, you'll have everything in there or nearly everything, and you say, hey, it's time to actually generate something and execute it. A good start for that would be, I think it's test 00, which does nothing but do a couple of prints. So in this case, all you have to have is the class structure, the translation for method, namely main, and the print and string literals and integers. So in that particular case, you'd say, okay, I've generated a .j, but how do I know if it's valid or not? Well, in programming, it's not subjective, it's very objective. And what happens is you simply take the .j file you've generated, put it through Jasmine, it'll create a .class file, which is the standard format that Java expects, and then run the Java executor on it. And if it's correct, you'll get expected output. If it's not correct, you'll get some problems. And again, as we discovered this weekend, it turns out that Jasmine is every bit as picky as programming in general. One of the amazing things about programs is that so many of them work when it's so easy to screw things up. Over the weekend, we had a problem that persisted a couple of days simply because it was so subtle, so minor, that it was not even obvious. And it turned out that in one particular case, in line two, the parent class for the class being generated is supposed to be the capo object class. But the person typing it in made the very easy error of having lowercase object. And what happened is Jasmine accepted that, The problem was that there is no lowercase object in the place that was specified. It's the uppercase O object. And that was, and it was a problem. This is kind of an artifact of the fact that Java has this notion that different casings of the same word are different identifiers. I continue to think that's a bad idea. And many of you, if you haven't already, may get nailed by the fact that if you mistype some case, either it won't be recognized or it may match something else. So yesterday, I think we had another problem where the case was that we added a string. What was the name of the string? Let was it? String val. String val. And it's got one casing for the thing added to do code generation, but there is also string val in the int lit node that simply represents the value of the string. But they were cased a little different, and in theory, they could coexist. In retrospect, that's a bad idea, and probably next time around, I'll change it more than that. So if you mistype one in terms of case, you get the other. And I've always thought the problem was if you say, what's the name of the variable and string val? Well, pronouncing it in English does not tell you, is the S or the V capitalized, or is it all lowercase, or perhaps even all uppercase? And to Java, it may make a difference. In fact, it will make a difference. But we're stuck with the language as it is, and people on the other side can make a case of why it ought to be done the way it was. But anyway, so be careful about that. It's something that's pretty easy to trip over, particularly if they coexist if you do it right, but if you do it wrong, you get one rather than the other, and it can be very misleading. And I think we spent better than, what would you say, an hour, was it probably, finding a silly little error. And it's not an error, you know, that you blame on anybody, because I do it all the time myself. When I'm typing in a program, I forget the case, but usually the compiler's smart enough to say, hey, this is not declared. And I say, oh, yes, it is, but no, I got the case screwed up. It should have been uppercase or lowercase or whatever. I correct it, and everything is fine. But occasionally, you get this thing where there are two guys that are so close together. I guess it's almost like two twins. There's always stories about identical twin brothers or sisters, and they play games like one goes out with the spouse of the other and decides how long they can fool them or something or other. You know, if you look exactly like somebody else, and presumably sound not too different, how long can you fool them thinking you're the other person and have all that sort of fun? In this case, it wasn't fun because if the two are so close that they're easy to get confused, it's something you can trip over. And at any rate, so be aware of that. Again, if it happens to one individual, and in fact, this case we had it in two different cases where two different individuals had a problem, so it may end up hitting you too. So let's see, okay, reference counting is back to code generation. So my intent now is to go to notes 3 and 4, but before I do that, I think now's a great time to handle any questions people have. Now's about the time to start getting some code generation stuff started. You really have a fair amount of time because the actual drop-dead accept date, I believe, is what, 2 weeks from today, I think, for the project. It's formally due on Friday of next week, which is still like 10 days, and then it has a grace period over the weekend for people who have fallen behind. But then our second exam, I believe, of the final is 2 weeks from today. And at that stage, I've got to get things graded. We have to make sure the TA has time to get things graded and put it all together so that by the end of that week or so, final grades can be sent in. It turns out that the university has a pretty strict policy where they simply turn off a program that accepts grades at some particular day and time. And what happens is you have to get special permission, get on your knees and say why it was wrong. You know, you had, you know, some terrible disease, or you got kidnapped and your parents just finally paid the reward, or maybe, you know, the kidnappers paid the reward to get rid of you, or whatever it might be, or something that important. So anyway, let me get out of this and get back to our notes and start looking at that. There it is. I knew I had it there somewhere. So again, these are the things I just handed out. So what you can do is have the paper in front of you also, and this is just talking points for me too. I think this is, come on, guy. No, I don't want you. I want you. Come on. There we go. So what we're going to be doing right now is start doing something to handle arrays. Now, arrays are a little special in Java because unlike other languages, arrays are always a heap-generated object. In many languages, as I showed you, for example, when we were talking about memory layout, an array is essentially a consecutive number of scalar variables allocated all at once. So if I had an array of 10 elements, I treat it pretty much as if you had declared 10 integer single values and just allocate them consecutively. And I could then do some arithmetic to find out where the array sub 7 is or the array sub 2 is or et cetera. Turns out that that has problems in languages that do it that way, like C or even C++, because what happens if you have a negative index? That's normally not allowed, but actually it turns out in some cases, for historical reasons, C actually allows you to set an index that's negative. It doesn't point to anything, and it's sort of like a gentleman's agreement that says, I'll set the index here, but I won't actually fetch a value until the index goes good. Alternatively, sometimes you can create an index past the end of the array. That's oftentimes erroneous. It's used by hackers sometimes as a way to get at data that they shouldn't be able to get at. So, for example, you may have access to somebody's name and address for benign purposes, but it may be that their password or account number or something that's more important is laid out very close to that. So if I said, instead of having array element 1 for your name, array element 2 for your middle initial, array element 3 for your last name, if I went to array element 5, 6, or 7, I may be able to get some information that's very valuable, like your account number, your password, or something. So what Java decided to do is they'd put the array elements in a separate object. That means address-wise, it's going to be in a different area of memory, and they would automatically force array bound checking. Array bound checking is not mandatory in most languages. Now, again, I don't know, is it mandatory in Cache? I assume you have arrays. What happens if you have a bad index? Does it kill you, or you just get garbage? Okay, get null, sometimes sort of in the middle. It turns out that in Java, it always enforces that. People complain that, oh, gee, that means the program's going to be slower. But I've always been just amazed that some smart lawyers haven't gotten onto the fact that in a language like C or C++, you're intentionally running a program that has security flaws. And you could argue that's malpractice in the same sense that a physician gives you too powerful a drug and you have side effects that are bad, the physician can get sued. And if you ever watch late night TV, about half the ads are from some lawyers trolling around, did you take this medication? We're going to sue the bejesus out of somebody. Or, you know, do you have a bad hip? Well, it's, you know, that it's this byproduct, or on and on and on. Well, they don't do that for programs, but they could, because arrays in C and C++ are not mandatorily checked. In fact, there's all sorts of things in C and C++ that aren't checked. Like in Java, all variables have to be initialized. Not true in C or C++. Sometimes it turns out by just sheer luck, the initial value you get is acceptable. Other cases, it's not, and crazy things happen. So for our purposes, what happens is that arrays are treated like objects. So we're going to get a little bit of flavor of heap allocation, if only for allocating arrays. It turns out that we also have this notion that Java had that I sort of disagree with. And the good thing about owning a language is you can do it your way. And that's the question, let me find my markers here, of what array assignment really means. So let me temporarily. So if we have array 1 gets array 2, what exactly does that mean? In terms of variables, or are there any scalar variables like I gets J, it's pretty uniform. It means, again, assuming the types are correct and you don't need to do some kind of conversion, it says whatever bit pattern J had, representing, let's say, an integer, is copied in I. So I and J have the same value at this stage, but they're different memory locations. I and J are different names, so you have the expectation they're going to be different memory. Starting with C, and C++ and Java followed it, for arrays, that's not true. In terms of arrays, when you do an assignment, particularly as I mentioned, arrays are essentially allocated as heap objects and accessed through a reference. If I say A1 and A2 and do that assignment, all that means is that block of memory, the heap object that A2 used to point to, A1 now also points to it, but there's only one allocation of array elements. And that means from here on out, an assignment to A1's elements implicitly signs changes A2's corresponding element, because it's not a different element. It's the same element named differently. And of course, that's very dangerous. And there's always this question, should that be done or not? Many earlier languages had the rule following the same thing as scalars, that if I assign an array, that means I'm actually going to physically create a new block of memory, copy the values over, and A1 and A2 will point to initially the same array, but not in memory. They'll be the same values, but in different places, so that an assignment to A1 does not affect A2 or vice versa. So it's just a matter of what you think things ought to mean. So the question is, well, why did they do that? Well, as we get to richer and richer languages, data structures get bigger and bigger. So just imagine what would happen is if you had a huge structure that represents a hash table implementing, for example, a database. And again, you probably have that in some of your products. If you assign the database from one to the other, does that mean you physically copy potentially a huge structure that has hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, millions of elements? And the answer is probably not. They probably have some sort of sharing where they share the same basic elements, but you have some way of localizing changes done on your copy versus someone else's. So oftentimes on very fancy, very big structures, you'll have a shared main data object, and that is big. And your copy and this copy might have a little table, perhaps implemented as a hash table, of the differences. So assume this is an array that had a million elements. And I'm still one of these old guys, thinking a million, remember the situation. Do you want to be a millionaire in all situations? Oh my God, I want $1 million. And then you start doing the arithmetic. If you're a young person like you, you say, well, maybe I've got 50 years left, hopefully more. If you want $1 million and you have 50 years to spend it, how much is that per year? Anybody good at doing arithmetic in their head? How much? Excuse me? Well, no, you had a million, so it's got to be a two in there somewhere, right? 20,000. I mean, 20,000 is okay, but nobody's going to retire on 20,000 these days. I guess the poverty level, if you have a family, is around that range. So it's one of these crazy things. A million used to be big. Even in computing now, it's not, mega, you say a mega this or a mega that, boo, ho-hum. You must have good quality pictures that are megapixels in size, which means they're certainly megabytes in size. So I'm going to pretend it's a million, but that's just my old-fashioned way. And what would actually happen, and again, this is where some good programming comes in there, is that you have to share the elements that are unchanged. But if this is A1 and this is A2, what happens is a change to A1 might say, hey, here's a little hash table that says you decided that the third element of A1 was equal to 50. And what happens is you have a little table here and say, oh, I want A1. Has it been changed? Look it up in this table. If not, it's still the same as in the big table. And people do tricks like that. And again, you may have some of that in your software already. So I'm showing you one of the alternatives. Java showed you the others. There may be some sort of intermediate that says you share what you can, but you allow logically A1 and A2 to have different values as needed so that you don't have this terrible danger that somebody using the A1 array changes something and you don't realize it, and all of a sudden your A2 is different without you asking for it to be different or allowing it to be different. That's not so good either. So that being explained, what we have here are some utility routines, and these are again in CSX Live. They're pre-programmed. You're welcome to look at the source. It's there, but you can also use the compiled version. So we have things called clone. And these clone guys are there to support my notion of assignment. So when I assign one array to another, I clone the source array. That gives me a different memory location that has exactly the same values in it. And I give the assignment the new array, the newly created array, whereas the old one still exists. So my semantics are array assignments, copy data. But of course, that means it's slower because the clone is at least going to be proportional to the size of the array. If I had a million elements, it's going to take a million steps to read, copy, read, copy. These days, that's not all that much, but it may be noticeable. So that's the issue there. We also have something which we'll use that gives you the ability to get some extra credit if you're looking at it. Namely, if you remember your type checker, we had this rule that said arrays have to have the same size to be assigned. Again, this is something that Java does not force, and I've always been a little uncomfortable with. Because I always thought that the size of an array when you're assigning it around ought to be uniform. If A2 gets assigned to A1 and all of a sudden its size is different than I expect, I have fewer or more elements, and neither of those is a very good situation. So what we have to do is check the size of the arrays. And remember, you can do that in the common case at type checking time, project 4, by simply saying source array, target array, do you have the same base type like ints, and do you have the same size? For user-declared arrays, you always have an integer representing the size, you can just check it. But we said that if one or both of the arrays were parameters, there's a case where we would not require the parameters have some fixed size. The reason for that is if you do that, you have this odd situation that if you have an integer sort on an array, it doesn't sort array integers. It sorts integers if the array is size 25. If you want to sort an array of 26 or 24, doesn't work. Wrong size, wrong type. I always thought that was kind of stupid. Oh, what happened here? Kind of went to sleep on me. Yeah, so back to there. So what happens here is in the case that one or both of the source and target are array parameters, then the size checking has to be done at runtime. So that means I can have a routine that does a sort of an array, for example. But if it sorts an array of size 25, it has to return an array of size 25. If it sorts an array of size 10, it has to return an array of size 10, et cetera, the sensible thing. So we have these things that what they do is they check the size of the array length. They throw an exception if the array lengths of the one parameter and the other, namely the source and target, are different. But if the sizes are okay, it just returns a reference to the array of that's going to be assigned. But notice that if it's the case, what do I do in the code generator? I'll show you in a moment. If I already did the size checking at compile time, and the answer is it still checks. Why? Special casing out the common but not guaranteed case that source and target arrays are just ordinary user-declared arrays. In that case, you've already checked. You don't need to do all this extra gobbledygook, but I do it anyway. So your basis for optimization is when you get around to doing this code generation, you can say, hey, I'm going to add an extra case that says if both the source and target arrays are ordinary user-declared arrays. How do you check that? Well, remember, you put type and kind information in the AST, and the kind is array versus array parameters. So both the source and target have kind that are arrays. You've already checked, and the size has to be correct. Otherwise, you would have failed type checking. If you fail type checking, you don't go into code generation. So you could have a special case that says if the source and target both are the same size, are both arrays rather than array parameters, you don't need to do this extra checking. So the things that go ahead and do the check integer array part can be bypassed, and all you do is a simple assignment. That is, you clone the source and take the clone and assign that to the target without any extra effort. So that's worth some extra credit. I did not do it because it just makes what I have to present to you that much more complex. But it's always a trade-off for making a code generator a tad more complex, but also making it more effective in terms of generating better code. So when we see those routines, the top three are to clone characters. The middle one is convert a string, so I can convert a string into a char. That's a type converter. And the last three are there for verifying that the arrays of the source and target are equal in all cases, including those that are parameters. So let's go ahead and do this. I want to say one more thing about I said that it turned out that arrays are treated as objects in Java. So the question comes up in the Java JVM, how do I actually go ahead and get data out of an array? You can't actually go into the center of the array and grab data. It doesn't allow you to do that because it has to do array bounds checking. So the way the code generator works, and we'll see this, but let me just show to you for a moment, is that if we have this operand stack, and I want to say something like, give me A sub I, what happens is you push not one operand, but two onto the operand stack. One is a reference to A. Effectively, that's a pointer to where the heap object is, so I can get at the array. And then what you do is push I as an integer. And then there's an instruction that takes the top two elements, and in that particular case says, in the reference, the array reference A, and with the integer I, let's go ahead and fetch the value of A sub I if I is a valid index. If it's not, you may have done this when you're taking 367, for example, you get an error that says there's an array bound error that says you gave an index that was not allowed. In the case that you're assigning to an array, it gets even more clever, I guess. You push the name of the array, you push the reference for the position, and then you push the value being assigned, which is 1, and you have now array assign instruction that takes 3 different parameters pushed on the stack, the location of the array, the subscript index that's going to be affected, and the actual value being assigned. And again, it does, it being the Java runtime system, guarantees that you're not playing any tricks. The array index has to be correct. This has to be a valid integer if you're assigning into an integer array. If you had an array of something else, like an array of objects, then the type of the object and the array of objects would have to have the same type. So it guarantees you're not at runtime tricking the type system at something that shouldn't be done. So that's just a preview of how we're going to try to generate code. Why? Because that's the way the JVM does it, and we have to coexist with it. It's not really a bad system, because notice a lot of work that you would otherwise have to do is done automatically. For example, you don't have to fetch out the size of the array and verify I's in those ranges. It does that for you. You don't have to go ahead and make sure that the value being assigned to the array is the proper value. If it's invalid, for example, you're trying to assign a string literal into an element of an array of integers, it would say, no, 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 no. This is an array of integers. This is a string literal. They are not acceptable. And it would give you an error saying that was erroneous. Or it might be that you're a hacker trying to break the system, and that's something that simple is not going to be effective. So what we have here is we're returning to name node. And we had the case where we took a very simple sort of unsubscripted identifier that was a scalar. And we've added the stuff in the middle where it says var name is an array or array parameter. So in this particular case, what we're going to do is we're going to load a reference to the array, depending on whether it's global or local. We'll fetch it from a field or we'll fetch it from a particular slot in a frame. And this is the stuff I was talking about a moment ago that is brand new, namely, here's how we actually go about getting the value of A sub I. So remember, a name can have an identifier, always has an identifier, but it can also have an index. And if the identifier is an array, that's how we do A sub I. So in that particular case, we push the array reference first. So we fetch it out of a global or local location and put it on the stack, as I illustrated a moment ago. Then we go ahead and visit the subscript value, which has the effect of computing the subscript value. It may be something as simple as literal, or it might be something that requires a computation, like give me the value of I minus 1 or I plus 1 or 2I minus 3 or whatever the particular need is. And then based on type, it does this load instruction that has a different prefix. I, B, or C are for integer, Boolean, or character. And A is the code it uses for a reference. So it essentially says, we're taking a reference and we're going to produce an integer or a Boolean or a char. That's the name they chose, and we're just copying it forward. So you'll have to go ahead and expand your routine that does name. And this says, I'm visiting a name node. Please do whatever computations are necessary to put the value of that name, either as a scalar or as an indexed array, onto the stack. And these cover all the cases, a simple scalar, or the case that you're evaluating an array, presumably to do an assignment, or you're indexing an array to get a component of that array. And I think this is the final version of that. So you'll be able to take this. Again, you'll have to add some type information, maybe a little casting. But this should be pretty complex in terms of names, which are used in a lot of locations. So this is an important thing to have. Remember, besides computing the value of a name, we also sometimes want to compute the address of a name. That's in the case typically where it's being assigned to. It's the left-hand side of an array. So in this particular case, we have an array. We're going to go ahead and load, again, the reference. If we're subscripting, here's the case where we go ahead and push the name of the array, the reference to the array, and the subscript. But we don't actually generate code yet because we're simply setting up an assignment given here's the name of the array, here's the index. We're now going to compute the value to be assigned and then do the opcode that actually does the move. We have a routine that says store into a name. And this is where we get into some of the stuff I showed you earlier. In the case of a scalar, it's pretty routine. In the case that it's an array, here's where we're doing the check array length. And here's the spot where I mentioned earlier you could do a bit of optimization. So in this case, simply based on the type integer, boolean, or char, I, in this case, have pushed onto the array the array reference for the left-hand side and the array reference for the right-hand side. So I'm doing A1 gets A2, for example. But now I have to check that A1 and A2 have the same size, not necessarily knowing whether that's been verified or not. So I pushed A1 and A2. This little code, based on the type, goes in there and checks, are your lengths the same? If they are, fine. Otherwise, it throws an exception, essentially an array size exception, saying you're trying to change the size of the array. That's not allowed. And if it is valid, it simply then leaves the reference for the source array, which is the brand new array that you just created, and leaves that there saying, okay, we passed the test. This array is valid. You now may continue using it for the store. And how do we store the array? Well, depending on whether it's global or local, it goes into a field or goes into a frame. And in the case of subscripting, in this particular case, we've gone ahead and pushed the array name, the index, and the value. And in this case, we then do a store based on whether it's integer, boolean, or char. So it looks a little bit odd, but if you actually go through the steps, it generates the stuff in the right order and everything comes out nicely. And finally, here's the visit. This is actually doing the assignment with all the setups. So as before, what happens is the first thing we do is compute the address of the source. That may generate no code at all. Oftentimes it doesn't. It simply says, let's store information in the node of whether it's a global or a local, what the field name is, or what the actual slot in the frame is. So that's put into the node so I have access to it when I generate code. If it's an array, notice what I have to do is do a clone. This is the sort of situation where I don't want to reuse the reference for the source and target. I'm going to have the source clone it to give me an exact copy of the array, but in a new location, and I'll leave that on the stack. And I do a special test to see if it's a string. I got to do that conversion stuff. And then I do that store name business. And remember, that store name business is where we also can do the length checking and all. So it fits in a couple of places. But this is essentially what we have to do assignments, including arrays and also indexing arrays and making sure those both work. And this is, again, a little bit more complex because arrays now are implemented as references, as Java requires. So we have to go ahead and create references and do the appropriate instructions that modify them. So any questions on that? Again, it's a little detailed, but we have enough detail in there that what you want to do is be sure that you're comfortable with what each step is doing and then pretty much just follow the logic as it's given. To the best of my knowledge, that is all valid code tested by by me testing it and running it for my own particular version. Okay, let's go on and do increments. Remember, we have increments and decrements. I think I'm showing you increment, decrement is very similar. That's just a plus, plus, and minus, minus. And at first blush, that looks pretty easy. And for ordinary scalars, it is pretty easy. So let's go ahead and look at the first part of this and says, well, what do I do if I have i++, where I is a simple integer, for example? Well, in that particular case, what I do is I already have the name I already been visited. So in this particular case, I visit the target. That puts the I, for example, on the stack. And it says plus plus simply says do a plus of one. So I go ahead and push one on the stack by doing load I, load an integer. So it does a load constant of one onto the stack. So now I have I and one sitting on the stack. And then I do an integer add, which replaces it with I plus one. Okay, that's pretty easy. But again, sometimes in programming languages, when you get a couple of options matching together, we get a problem. And here's a problem when I want to do increments, not for a simple variable, but for an indexed array element, which is legal. So what I essentially said is I plus plus is essentially equivalent to simply going ahead and computing I plus one. And let's see, did I show it here? Oh, let me go back a moment. Stopped one, mounted two. So we do the add, but then we have to go ahead and compute the address and do the store of I. So what that means is we computed I plus one, and then we set up I equals I plus one. And that's fine. But what happens if we have something like A sub j plus plus? The question is, can I legally go ahead and say what this means is A sub j equals A sub j plus 1 and implement it that way? Well, it turns out actually in this case I can, but in the case that j were a function call, like call function f, which is an integer function that returns an integer, would that be valid? And the answer turns it's not, because the notion is you want the I being fetched and the I being incremented to be the same location. But if this were a function f, like what could it be? It could be a random number generator. Some algorithms work by essentially randomly working through a data structure. We haven't talked about that. Some other classes in computer science may. But there's a whole variety of randomization algorithms that say a good way to get an answer is not to do every last step, but do enough testing that you can essentially get a very safe estimate of what the answer is going to be. They do that, for example, this is election time or so on, and they do these polls, which turn out apparently to be very successful. If they say so-and-so is going to win, they usually do. Well, it's not just elections, but you can actually do that in other computations where you have a huge amount of data, and you don't need to get an exact answer to 10 or 20 decimal places. You just need to get an answer close enough. That's sort of the engineering approach, where scientists love to know something to 20 or 30 decimal points. Engineers say, is it good enough that it'll run? And the answer is yes, it is. But in this particular case where I'm incrementing an element of an array, I don't want to reevaluate that array index more than only once. I can't do it more than once because I may be touching a different location. Is that likely to happen? The answer is heck no. Could it happen? Yes. And this is a case where we have to generate code that handles that case. And in some cases, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. It's sort of a situation, randomly find a location and increment that one. Then randomly find another location to increment it and do some number of increments, just enough to give you the character of what the structure is going to be like after the increments. And again, I can't give you the details of that. I'm not sure I fully understand them myself. But there's some very clever and smart algorithms that do that sort of thing. And we're just the low-level serfs who have to go in there and make sure that the code we generate follows the rules. So what that means is, down here, what we're going to do is we're going to push the array and index. So remember that if we go ahead and say, compute the address, that pushes a reference to the array and the index onto the stack. And then we use this instruction, which I haven't shown before, but as you might have guessed, it has to be there. If we have a stack-oriented structure, we always know there are pop locations, there are pop operations, and we've seen those implicitly. For example, when you call a method, the arguments are pushed on the stack, but they're automatically popped off at the point of return because you no longer care about them once the call has occurred. Well, we have operations that essentially take the top however many stack elements and duplicate them. So dupe simply means duplicate. And in this case, I'm going to take the top two elements, which are the array and the index, and duplicate them. So I have two copies. And kind of let's see what's going to go on, because I think this turns out to be pretty clever. How did I figure it out? The answer is, of course, I didn't. When you want cleverness, the first thing you do is see if you can steal somebody else's cleverness. You know, why reinvent the wheel is what the saying goes. And what happens is, if I'm trying to do a sub I plus plus, what I'm going to do is I'm going to push onto my stack a reference to A and the value of I. And then I'm going to do that dupe, which duplicates those two values, and it duplicates them in the same relative order, by the way. So reference to A and a value for I. And although I haven't shown it yet, I'll go ahead and do it. And then what we do is we push a 1. Let's see. Do we do that yet? Yeah. We push the 1 on there. And what happens in this particular case, before we push the 1, we go ahead and fetch this value, getting a sub I. Then we push the 1. Then we do an add, which gives me a sub I plus 1, the value. And I still have the earlier value of I and the reference of A for the store. Remember, array stores take a value, an index, and an array, and there they are. So that's what we're setting up, and it's easier if I help you visualize it. So what we're doing here, so here I get the computer address, essentially pushes A and I onto the stack. I duplicate them, so I have AI, four elements on the stack. I have to break page here. What I do is I do a load of the elements. So that gives me the value of A sub I in the stack. And then here's where I push the 1, do the add, and then do the store. And this guarantees me that no matter what the value of I was, it could have been a function call that computed it, the same location is used to fetch the value of A sub I, to do the add, and then to store it back. So this turns out to be slightly more complex. But again, the Java people being very smart figured that out for me. So I just simply said, show me the code you would do, and looked at it and said, hey, that's pretty clever. I think I'll do that too. And away we went on that. And let's see, okay, we're making good time on this. I think, yeah, we got a few minutes left. That was all of number 3 code generation. Let me verify that. Again, a lot of detail there, but one of the reasons I gave you in such detail is it's easy enough to make a minor mistake. So at this stage, what you really want to just be comfortable with is the big picture. You know, what it is we're doing. And again, if you're looking for some extra credit, as I said, you know, a couple of places where that's possible. Certainly the situation there where we do the unnecessary length check for arrays is a good spot to do some optimization, because I believe in many programs, arrays will essentially be assigned not in methods, but in the program where they're created. I'm just guessing that, but if I'm correct, then it's a good optimization. So let's just get a little started on the other segment. Oh, but again, let me see. Are there any questions on what we did on part 3 or parts 1 and 2 and how they all fit together? So let's go in and finalize all this with the final section. Here it is. And this is the notes of 4. And what we're going to do here is now we're finally going to do the outermost structure, the things that have to be generated for all programs. And one of the nice things about this is that the structure is pretty much the same for all programs. So let's look at that and appreciate what's going on. We're doing a couple of things. We're essentially going to go ahead and generate a class name. Now remember, the notation I'm using is this capital CLASS is not the actual word class. Rather, that's a shared variable that's been initialized to the actual class name the user gave the program, extracted from the top of the AST. As you remember, a class node up top has fields and methods, but it also has an identifier that says, I'm the name of the class. So in that particular case, what you do is extract that, and that's what the very first line does. So the first couple of lines, at least. So one of the things we have to say is, initially, we're going to process fields. So the way we recognize we're processing fields is simply by saying the current method equals null. Remember, method points to the method we're currently in. In most programs, in Java and in CSX, virtually all the user's code is inside one or the other methods. The only thing that isn't a method are fields, which start at the very beginning, and this class stuff, which is up at the top. So initially, we're not in a method. So we recognize that by essentially saying the current method is null. I think this is good use for null, because does current method always exist? The answer is no. We're not always in the method, usually, but not always. So we can ask, am I in the method or not, by simply saying, is that particular reference null or not? So we set that up. We then go ahead and go into the class name and extract that name. So class here has to be declared as a variable. It should be put up in the code generator, that is in code generating class, up where it's accessible to all the various methods, because any and all of them may want to know what class you're in, and also be accessible to any of the library routines, utility routines we have. Is there a question?
Anything in the default package comes back with null. There's not a package name. If I'm just playing around with it and I'm asking Java, I'm like, what's a package and all that kind of stuff, it doesn't have one.
Right. And classes don't need to have packages. You can compile at the class level.
Okay, so but then when you're using Java, like string, it's telling you it's in Java lang, you know, string. So when do you need to say for a particular class or whatever that it has? This is the file path to it or not?
Well, usually what happens is it's you're sitting in that actual folder. That's the easiest way. It's always relevant. If you are at the command line level, you can create something called a class path. But normally what will happen here is that if you're sitting in a particular folder, and usually we put the things in bin, you can execute out of bin along with everything else, and it finds it fine. So you need to do packages if you have some structure outside of where you're currently going. But I decided not to do that because we're compiling a class at a time, given that's the unit of compilation. So I thought putting a package around it was unnecessary. And it does work, as I've tested that. So packages might be used, but it's another level of complexity. So what we're doing then is these first two lines then are setting up class. And remember, in all the other notes, when you see capital CLASS, it's assuming that this line I've already shown you has been executed. How do I know it's been executed? Well, remember, we start at the root of the tree, and we're visiting class node, which is the very root. So this is one of the very first things done, is method gets set, current method is null, and class gets initialized. So at this stage, you're done. In fact, if you wanted to, you could even make class final, and once it's initialized, it's unchangeable. That's one of the things where you may have noticed in a lot of places I make various fields final. And the reason for that is that's my estimation that once this thing is initialized, it won't change. In many cases, that's a very handy thing because if something looks like it's got garbage, the first question you ask is who trashed it? Well, if something's final, there's only one guy that could have trashed it, and that's the guy that initialized it, so it helps you debug much better. And in many programming languages, the thing that I like least about C or C++ or Java, or in our case CSX, is that it has variables that are allowed to change freely. Seems like that's natural, but if you set things up, it ought to be, some things have to change, like a loop index. For I equals 0 to 1,000, I's got to change around. Or if you have some kind of pointer to a list that's traversing around a list, that's got to change. But there's a lot of data that doesn't change. For example, you may put something into a class element as data, and it's not going to change within that object. You may create other objects that have different data in them, but once this object's created, this data may change, may not change. So if, for example, you're creating a transaction record for a patient or a customer of some sort, presumably, while your program's running, the person's name's not going to change. I don't know, do people get married in hospitals? They get married in all kinds of exotic spots, but I don't think hospitals are all that romantic. So presumably the person's names are not going to change, so you initialize it and leave it. And in many cases, one of the things I'm sure you've already learned this or thought about it, is when you make a field available, do you want to make it final or not? And that really boils down to, once it's initialized, is it likely going to change or not? By making something final, you make life harder. Because if, for example, some patient wanted to change their name because you did something silly like mistyped their name. Some people have long and complex names that are hard to type and how to pronounce. Then you may have to go back and make it non-final for a correction, but generally not. So anyway, we'll get back to this. That was my little reminder. So let's take 10 minutes, and at about 6:40, we'll come back and finish up these notes. Then we'll have a little time to talk about code generation, and we'll be out of here for today.